So if you have Bibles, open them to Psalm 22. And we're going to try and look at the whole psalm this morning. And we're going to ask the question as we look at this psalm, where is God when it really hurts? Where is God when I'm really hurting? Because it's a good question. Where is God when I'm really hurting? See, if the subject of God, if the subject of Jesus comes up on the street with someone you're chatting to, someone who's not a Christian, I don't reckon it will be too long before that person says to you, yes, that's all very well that you're talking about a God of love, but where was your God of love when my husband was dying of cancer? Where was your God of love when my child was raped? Where was your God of love when I'm suffering? It's a massive question. Where is God when it really hurts? When I was summer before last, I was working on a mission in Ponta de Leis. And the idea of the mission was, we had a theme going through the mission. Every evening before preaching, we'd have an interview with somebody who had something to share. One night, the theme was, how can I be a Christian and how can you be a Christian and a successful sportsman? So we had a successful sportsman, I can't remember who it was, chatting about his experiences as a sportsman and as a Christian. On the Tuesday night, a Christian and a successful businessman. We had the guy who ran Spa. He's a Christian. He came to chat about how being a Christian affects his business life. Now, it was reasonably busy throughout the week, but the busiest night of all was the Wednesday when we had a night dealing with suffering. We had a guy whose daughter was killed in the Lockerbie bombing, and he was chatting about how being a Christian had affected the way he looked on that tragedy. Now, people have got lots of issues. People want to be sportsmen. People want to be successful businessmen. But in Ponta de Leis, the biggest question on people's lips was, where is God when I'm suffering? They wanted to hear what that man had to say when he was suffering about God. To the person who's not a Christian, that's the biggest question there is. Where is God when I'm suffering? But to Christians, it's not an issue, is it? Because as Christians, we have a hope. We have a solid rock, a solid foundation. Whatever happens to us, whatever trial, whatever trouble comes, we know that we will be okay because God is for us. Who can be against us? We love using that verse, don't we? Whatever happens, you know, non-Christians, people who aren't Christians, well, they will ask the question, where is God? But where? We're Christians. If God is for us, who can be against us? We never ask that question, do we? Or do we? Where is God when it really hurts? Does being a Christian stop us from asking that question? Where is God? I'm hurting. Where are you? I'm suffering. This psalm shows us that that is a Christian reality. Look at Psalm 22. We've got a description of a man who's suffering. And not only is he suffering, but he feels like God has completely abandoned him. Do you feel this morning like God has completely, completely abandoned you? Do you feel like your prayers are just bouncing off the ceiling? Do you feel dry? And what's worse, you're suffering and you feel dry. You're having no satisfaction from God at all. According to this psalm, you're in good company. Why? Because the psalm tells us right at the top, it's a psalm of David. Who's David? Who is this guy? Who is this guy that understands how I feel? Well, he's David. He ruled Israel and Judah nearly 1,000 years before Jesus was born. Now, there's a lot we can say about David. We could say that he went from being the youngest of a family of shepherds to being this national pinup, this national icon, to then becoming some fugitive like Harrison Ford, being running around Israel, being chased by Saul and his army, to then finally becoming a king. Now, there's a lot of good things we can say about David. The Psalms or the Bible describes him as a man after God's own heart. That is, there was something unique about him that made him understand exactly what God felt. And he was able to express in the same way that which God feels. There's a lot of good things about David. There's also a lot of bad things about David. I mean, he was capable of the very worst stuff that we are capable of. Adultery? No, we're all capable of that. He was a shocking father. He was a shocking father. He was a terrible father. What I'm trying to say is David was like you or me. He was capable of the highs. He was capable of the spiritual highs. Psalm 23, the Lord's my shepherd, I shall not want. He's capable of the spiritual lows. My God, why have you forgotten me? Why have you forsaken me? Now, we don't know why he's writing Psalm 22. The psalm doesn't give us any clues as to the reason behind the psalm. But what we know is what we've said. This is David. He's once felt close to God, but now he's distant from God. And David is getting no encouragement from God. Look at the way it starts. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me from the words of my groaning? Now when I read that, I imagine a guy on his knees at the side of his bed pleading with God, please show yourself to me. Why are you doing this to me? What have I done? Why? Where are you? Now he knows that this is not the God of the Bible. He knows that his experience is not the experience of people in the Bible. Look what he says. Yet you are holy, enthroned on the praises of Israel. In you our fathers trusted. They trusted, and you delivered them. To you they cried, and they were rescued. In you they trusted, and they were not put to shame. But that's not my experience. Everyone else thinks he's wasting his time. All his family. They're all saying, why are you trusting in a God you can't feel? That's not affecting your life. Why are you wasting your time? All who see me mock me. That's what he says. They make mouths at me. They wag their heads. That is, they pity me. He trusts in the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, or if he delights in him. That's what his family, that's what his friends are saying about him. And the worst thing about it, the very worst thing about it, is he knows he's been close to God in the past. And you can remember a time of being satisfied and being really content with God. But now, all that's left is a massive, gaping, empty sense of where are you now? Yet, you are he who took me from the womb. You are he who took me from the womb. You made me trust you at my mother's breast. On you was I cast from my birth, and from my mother's womb you have been my God. Trouble is growing. He's having sleepless nights. Everywhere he turns, things are getting worse and worse. Enemies are surrounding him. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, and there is none to help. Many bulls encompass me. Strong bulls of Bashan, like they open wide their mouths at me, like ravening and roaring lions. Enemies are surrounding him. No satisfaction from God. Is that you this morning? Is that how you feel? Now I know you wouldn't dare say it. You know, perish the thought that we turn up to a prayer meeting and actually pray about something like this. I know that that's not what good little evangelicals do. How are you doing? I'm well. I'm well. Now, how are you really doing? Oh, man, I haven't felt God in weeks. Perish the thought that we were actually honest about these things. Is that how you feel this morning? You know, I can, as a Christian, I felt this. This is the Christian reality. Sometimes we will feel like this. Is that how you feel this morning? Do you feel like God has completely abandoned you, completely left you? All you can think of is, my God, why have you forsaken me? If that's you this morning, I've got the best news for you. This morning you're going to be satisfied. God is for you, and he hasn't abandoned you. Let me show you how. Let me show you why. Well, like I said, this song, this psalm, is a song and was written by David. David was a king. But in Acts chapter 2, David is described as something else. He's described as a prophet. And that's really important. Because when we look at this psalm, we can see that it's describing events that are going to happen in the future. Now, like I said, this psalm was written around 1,000 years before Jesus was born. And yet this psalm describes perfectly an event in Jesus' life. This psalm describes Jesus' death. This psalm describes Jesus' suffering. It's known as his passion. What I'd like to do this morning is spend about half an hour showing you how Jesus' passion, how his suffering was predicted by David in this psalm in three ways. The three ways are this: the trauma of abandonment, the trauma of suffering, and the trauma of death for the triumph of glory. And then hopefully by the end of the psalm, by the end of going through it, we'll see how God hasn't abandoned us and how, in spite of how we feel, God will never abandon us and is in fact set up something fantastic for us. And I'm excited to get to that, so let's start. The first thing I've got to show you is the trauma of abandonment. The trauma of being left all by yourself. Now imagine this, imagine the scenario. You haven't got a 24-year-old Lewis standing in front of you. You've got a 6-year-old Lewis standing in front of you. And he runs up to you and he says, look what I've got in my pocket. No, I'm not wearing a smart shirt and tie. I'm wearing a grubby t-shirt. And I've got mud up to my shoulders. My jeans are muddy. And I'm going, look, to show you. I got my hand in my pocket and you say, what have you got to show me? What have you got? And I pull out of my pocket the longest, slimiest, most horrible worm you've ever seen in all your life. It's disgusting and I can barely grab it, it's so slimy, and it's slipping out of my hands. Now, if you're anything like my mum, the first thing you'll do in that situation is grab hold of the worm and you'll chuck it out the window, because you don't want that stinking worm in your nice new building. Because worms are disgusting. People don't like worms. When I did stuff like that when I was 6 years old, my mum had always just cleaned the kitchen. She was always still in her marigolds. The place was still shining. She didn't appreciate me walking into the kitchen with a stinking, slimy worm. She would grab hold of it, chuck it out the window, because worms are disgusting. People can't look at them. They're horrible-looking things. And yet, that is the word that David chooses to use when he's describing how people will one day look at Jesus. Look at verse 6. But I am a worm and not a man. That is, David is saying that one day people will look at this Jesus and they will be disgusted by him. Somehow David sees that the Messiah, that is Jesus, would be looked upon with disgust by his fellow men. Hours before his death, people would be disgusted by him. And in Matthew's Gospel, we see this being fulfilled. And kneeling before him, they mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they spit on him. And they took the reed and they struck him on the head. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the robe and put his own clothes on him and led him away to crucify him. Now John's Gospel goes further. It says that when Pilate presents Jesus to the crowd of people and goes, "Behold, your king!" What do the crowd say back? They say, "Away with him. We can't even look at him. Get him out of our sight. He disgusts us. We don't want anything to do with him. Away with him." And that's before he hung on the cross. What happened whilst he was hanging there? Well, Luke tells us. Remember the 5 days before. Now remember who this Jesus is. 5 days before Jesus was crucified, he's riding into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey. And people are going nuts. People are getting all excited. They're thrilled to see him. What are they saying? They're rejoicing and they're praising God with a loud voice for all the mighty works that they had seen, saying, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord." That's what they're saying about Jesus. They're all excited to see him. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. This is the king we've been waiting for. This is him. And yet, 5 days later, Jesus is hanging on the cross and he's struggling for breath. And I can imagine those same people that were there with the palm leaves, getting all excited, hail to the king. Those same people, 5 days later, spitting on him and deriding him. As Matthew says, wagging their heads and saying, you who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. So also the chief priests and the scribes and elders mocked him, saying, he saved others. He cannot save himself. He is the King of Israel. Let him come down from the cross and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now, if he desires him. For he said, I am the Son of God. And the robbers who were crucified with him also reviled him in the same way. Now what I'm trying to show you here is can you see that there isn't a corner of the society that didn't abandon Jesus, in spite of how they felt 5 days previously? There wasn't a corner of the society that weren't disgusted by him, as if he were some big worm. From the religious elite to the common folk who would get all excited with the palm leaves, to the robbers. There wasn't a single corner of this society that didn't despise him. And it's just like Psalm 22, isn't it? Look what Psalm 22 says. But I am a worm and not a man. This is verse 6, I think. Scorned by mankind and despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They make mouths at me. They wag their heads. He trusts in the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, for he delights in him. Do you know that as the gospel accounts go on, or every one of the gospel writers employ the same technique to show how Jesus is becoming more and more isolated? And I don't know if you've noticed this. It really struck me when it jumped out. It really struck me. It seemed so significant. How many people are there in the upper room? When Jesus is at the Last Supper, there are at least 12. But something significant happens. Judas gets up and he leaves. So we're down to 11, aren't we? Those 11 go with Jesus to the Mount of Olives. But how many go into Gethsemane with him? Only 3. Peter, John and James. And of those 3, how many stay awake when Jesus asks him to stay awake? None. How many of those 3 then go with him to the courtyard after he's arrested? 2. And what happens there? John is standing far off with a bunch of women. And Peter says he wants nothing to do with Jesus. Can you see that every one of the gospel writers, they employ the same technique? Jesus is becoming more and more isolated, more and more abandoned as the account of the Passion goes on. Jesus is being left alone. Jesus is being abandoned. Just like Psalm 22 said. Now this morning, is that how you feel? Is this how you and your husband feel? Like you're all alone. Like you're rejected by everyone. Like even your friends are dropping away. You're being laughed at. If that's how you feel this morning, you're not only in the company of King David, you're in the company of Jesus. Jesus understands what you're going through right now, exactly what you're going through. In the book of Hebrews, later on in the New Testament now, there's a letter written to a bunch of Jews who are really struggling with they've become Christians, but they're finding it really hard. And they want to turn back to being Jews because it would be so much easier for them. And the writer writes to them. And he tries to encourage them. And he says to them, do you think you're alone? Do you think you're the only ones that are going through this? Do you think you're the first ones to go through this? Chapter 4, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses. We have a great high priest, he says, that knows what you're going through. And our high priest is Jesus. Look at Psalm 22. He's been abandoned.
If you feel abandoned, you're not by yourself. He understands. Jesus knows what it's like.
So that's the first thing I want to show you, the trauma of abandonment. Secondly, the trauma of suffering. Now this psalm deals with the cross very clearly. And the cross is, without wanting to be flippant, the cross is fairly fashionable nowadays, isn't it? The cross is everywhere. I mean, you can't walk down the street without being reminded of the cross somewhere. I was in a newsagent a couple of weeks ago and I saw a picture of Wayne Rooney, a footballer. You've had Jonathan Aubrey preach here, so I imagine you've heard of Wayne Rooney before. He uses him all the time as an illustration. Wayne Rooney stood in the front of a magazine, wearing no shirt, just a pair of jeans, and he stood in that shape. He stood in the shape of a cross. Next to that, this is no joke, the next to that magazine, there's a copy of GQ magazine. There's a copy of, that's GQ magazine. There's a copy of Rolling Stone magazine, the music magazine. And there's a picture of Kanye West, the rapper, American rapper. And he stood in the front of this magazine. And he also is not wearing a shirt. It's the summertime, after all. No one wears a shirt in the summertime. And he's got a crown of thorns on his head. And there's dabs of blood on his head also. And the headline is The Passion of Kanye West. Now, I don't think Kanye West is a Christian. But we can see that the cross has obviously had a big effect on those two photographs. In the newspaper then, a little while ago, I remember seeing a report about Madonna's last tour. I think it was called the Confessions Tour. I think she should probably confess to actually having had that tour. But the way she finished that tour, the way she finished the concert, was by standing and performing in the shape of a cross in front of a 30-foot disco cross. So this cross would be illuminated with these flashing lights, and she would be dancing in front of a 30-foot disco cross. Now, I know that's an unpleasant thing to think about. The cross means so much more to me than just an iconic symbol. But I think there's something quite significant happening there. Can you see that the horror of what was once a torture device? Well, society, we've just become so desensitized to how horrific that the cross is that we can be reminded of it and yet not moved by it. There's an account, isn't there, of where in the 04 revival, in Evan Roberts' diaries, he writes in his diary, one entry in his diary, he writes, "Lord, forgive me that I can look at the cross and not burst into tears." I mean, we naturally become desensitized to it, in spite of how horrific it is. But in this psalm, we can see that David was not desensitized to the horror of that first Good Friday. He knew that the Messiah would be tortured in the most horrific way. This psalm, look down, tells us about the way that Jesus would suffer on the cross. Now he's writing about someone in the future, and he's writing about someone's physical pain in the future. Now it's clear that he's not talking about his own experiences, but he's talking about someone else. And he's predicting Jesus' pain. Jesus, after being awake all night, after being lashed with a rope covered by broken porcelain and broken bits of glass, after being made to drag a beam of wood from within the city, from right in the middle of the city to outside the city, the place where he would be executed, is absolutely no understatement on the part of David to write in verse 14, "I am poured out like water, my heart is like wax that is melted within my breast. My strength is dried up like potsherd." Now what David is doing here is he's describing a man who simply hasn't got the energy to go on. He's aware that his body is shutting down. His body can take no more. There's very little strength left. His energy, if you will, is folding out like a dying candle. Like a few months ago, I left the house in a rush, and I didn't blow out a candle that my housemate had put on the mantelpiece.
When I came back, that candle, it was one of those big things. I'd completely just, well, it had been burning for so long, all the wax, the structure of the candle had completely gone. And it had just folded out on the side, as if its complete, all its strength had been used up. The wax had no strength at all. And those are the words that David uses here. My heart is like wax. It is melted within my breast. I just can't stand up anymore. I've got no strength. We see this fulfilled in the Gospels, don't we? In Luke's Gospel, tells the story of Simon of Cyrene. Simon of Cyrene, who was forced to carry the cross for Jesus because the Romans were so concerned that Jesus wouldn't even make it to Golgotha, that they forced someone else to carry the cross in his place. They didn't want to miss out on an execution. That was the best bit. So they forced someone to carry it for him. His energy is folding out like wax. Verse 16 is clearly about the crucifixion, isn't it? They have pierced my hands and feet. They can count all my bones. Now, we really see the prophetic nature of this psalm here, don't we? Did you know that crucifixion wasn't even first used in Israel until 900 years after this psalm was written? This psalm was written around 160 BC. This psalm was written about 900 BC. Crucifixion wasn't used until 160 BC. And yet, David describes with such clarity, they have pierced my hands and feet. Now, if you didn't know anything about crucifixion, that would be such a weird thing to read, wouldn't it? The psalm even tells us the detail. Jesus is thirsting on the cross. Look at verse 15. The Messiah's mouth is going to be so dry that his tongue would stick to his mouth. And 1,000 years later, Jesus is hanging on that cross and he says, I'm thirsty. And the best that they can offer him is some vinegar. But it's not just the suffering of pain that's predicted in Psalm 22, is it? But it's also the suffering of shame. Do you know that, we're affected so much by what we see. You know, so many of our ideas, biblical ideas, aren't actually biblical ideas at all. Whenever we think about the cross, I'm sure you picture Jesus in a loincloth, don't you? Because we've been affected by the Baroque and Renaissance paintings that depicted him wearing a loincloth. You know, Mel Gibson wouldn't dare make a film about Jesus dying on a cross not wearing a loincloth. But when they crucified people, they didn't wrap him in loincloth at all. He hung there naked. That's what the Bible tells us. They stripped people naked when they crucified them in order to make them feel shame. And Jesus was made to feel shame. Now, they strip people naked in order to make them feel shame for the things that they had done. The sin that they had committed, the law that they'd broken. Jesus was made to feel shame, not for the sin that he'd committed, not for the law that he'd broken, but for the law that we've broken, for the sin that we've committed. Don't you think that it's weird that in the garden, as soon as they sin, as soon as they fall, they're naked and they realise it and they want to cover themselves up because they feel shame. That's what Genesis chapter 3 tells us. They were naked and they felt shame. And when the curse is reversed on the cross, Jesus is stripped naked and he was made to feel shame. Not for his sin, because he committed no sin, but for our sin. And the curse is being reversed. And we see that fulfilled in Matthew's Gospel. He's stripped naked. They divide my garment among them. And for my clothing they cast lots. That's from the Psalm. And this is Matthew's Gospel. And when they crucified him, they divided his garment among them by casting lots. He understood suffering, didn't he, Jesus? He understood physical pain. He understood the feeling of shame as well. Are you this morning physically in pain? Are you in pain because of some illness? Are you in pain not because of some illness, but horribly because of a treatment for some illness? If you feel like that, Jesus understands. He knows what you're going through. But don't just wait there. I've got the best bit for you. It's coming up in a moment. But Jesus understands. We do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize. We have one who is able to sympathize. He knows what you're going through. Now, there's nothing worse, is there? There's nothing worse than someone saying to you, I know how you feel. Yeah, I know how you feel. There's nothing more patronizing than hearing that. You know, we had something horrible happen in our family a couple of years ago, and I remember someone coming up to me and saying, I know how you feel. I know how you feel. You do not know how I feel. You have not been there. There's nothing worse, is there, than someone saying to you, I know how you feel. Because they haven't been there. But Jesus, he says, I know how you feel, and he knows how you feel. There's nothing more wonderful than that sympathy, than that empathy. Finally, the trauma of death. The trauma of death for the triumph of glory. Now, are you Simpsons fans? It's unlikely, isn't it? Anyone watch The Simpsons? Anyone heard of The Simpsons? That's a start. Simpsons. Oh, please, can I have at least one hand up? There we go, thank you, there we go. Now then, right, for you two in the back, everyone else just bear with me. Simpsons, funny episode, Bart Simpson, little yellow boy, naughty kid, a bit like Dennis the Menace, but American. One day, Bart gets hold of these two walkie-talkies, and he chucks one down a well. Nod if you've seen this episode. And he goes and hides behind a bush. And he starts speaking into the other walkie-talkie. And he says, help, I'm trapped down a well. I'm a little boy, and I'm trapped all alone down a well. Have you seen this? It's worth seeing, it's funny. I've just spoiled it to you. Anyway, help, I'm trapped down the well. And it's not long before people hear a voice crying for help come from down the well, from a walkie-talkie. They don't know that. Help, I'm trapped down a well. And it's not long before, in Simpson style, everyone is there. Like, the whole town is there. The media is there. The fire brigade is there. The police are there. Everyone is there because they hear this voice crying for help. And they go. Now, in this psalm, we've got a voice crying for help. Look at verse 1. My God, why have you forsaken me? Look at verse 11, be not far from me, for trouble is near, and there is none to help. Verse 19, but you, O Lord, do not be far off. Save me, he says. There's a voice crying for help here. Now this is the voice of Jesus. This is the voice of Jesus crying for there to be any other way. But you see, unlike the Simpsons, where a voice is heard and people go to help, in this psalm, when this voice is heard, there will be no help. No one will come to Jesus' rescue. Now we hear the same voice. We hear exactly the same voice in Matthew 26. And going a little farther, he fell on his face and he prayed, saying, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. Three times Jesus prayed. If there's any other way, let there be another way. If there's any other way, I don't want to do this. If there's any other way. But this is the one prayer that God the Father would not grant Jesus. Now, do we know that? Can we imagine the magnitude of that? This is Jesus. This is, like we sung before, the Word of God. He was there in the beginning. This is the one who says, I and the Father, we are one. We are together. We are one in mind, in spirit. We are one. And yet, when Jesus was at his hour of need, when he's crying to the Father, if there's any other way, silence. Nothing. Nothing. Do we understand what's happening here? I can't understand this. Silence. Shortly after praying this in the garden, Jesus is betrayed, isn't he? falsely tried, he's falsely found guilty. He's lashed 39 times, he's laid across a beam of wood, his arms are stretched out, his hands are opened wide, mallets hammer large nails through his hands and feet. The cross is erected. He hangs there naked, he's freezing, he's dehydrating, and he's bleeding until he dies. And the reason why Jesus' cries were not answered, the reason why Jesus went through that, and this is the real comfort for you if you are suffering in that way tonight, this morning, is the reason Jesus went through that is in order for you to one day know God intimately and personally and wonderfully. Not just in this life, because that is no comfort. But in the next life, that doesn't end after 70 or 80 or 90 years. That goes on forever and ever. Look at the way the psalm finishes. Look at verse 19. You have rescued me from the horns of the wild oxen. I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will praise you. A bit on. For he has not despised or abhorred the affliction of the afflicted. And he has not hidden his face from him, but he has heard when he cried to him. A little bit on. The afflicted shall eat and be satisfied. Those who seek him shall praise the Lord. And then a little bit towards the end, posterity shall serve him. It shall be told of the Lord to the coming generation. They shall come and proclaim his righteousness to a people yet unborn, that he has done it. Now, what does that mean? That's like half the psalm. How come we're rushing through it? Well, very quickly, that second half of the psalm, well, it describes for us heaven. The second half of that psalm is heaven. And that is wonderful. Look at the way it's described. It's described as a place where people from every tribe and every nation will be one in mind and spirit, one in desire, and one in praise. Look at verse 27. All the ends of the earth, all the families of the nations shall worship before him. David sees not just people that he knows, the people who are not yet born, you and me, one day worshipping Jesus as King of glory. Posterity shall serve him. It shall be told of the Lord to the coming generation. They shall come and proclaim his righteousness to a people yet unborn. And what shall these people who are yet unborn, what shall we all be saying together? All these people that have suffered in the past, David, what shall we all be saying? All of us who have been suffering, who are suffering now, what shall we be one day saying in a great crowd of people? Verse 31, that he has done it. Isn't that amazing? One day, we're in heaven, all the suffering has ended, all the pain is gone, there is no more cancer, there is no more tears, there is no more crying. We're all stood together, and we all know we're there for one reason, and that is because he has done it. He has done it. He has done it by dying on a cross. He has done it when he said, "It is finished." If you are a Christian, this is your future. If you are a Christian, whatever you're suffering right now, whatever difficulty you're going through, and I'm not downplaying it, because I've not been there. Only you know. Jesus understands. And this psalm tells you that it will not last forever. That one day you will stand in a crowd of people from every tribe, every tongue, every nation. You will be perfect. You will see him as he is, and you will be like him. And you will be praising him, and all the suffering will be ended. Do you feel like God has forgotten about you? Verse 24, he has not despised or abhorred the affliction of the afflicted. He's not hidden his face from you, but he's heard when you cry. One day, 26 will be your reality. The afflicted, those in pain, those suffering will eat and will be satisfied. Those who seek him shall praise him. He has not left you. Guys, he's not left you. It's temporary. I'm not playing it down, but it is temporary. He did leave Jesus temporarily in order for you one day to know him in perfection.